ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. The lighter side of genocide, because in the world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humor, you'll go friggin' nuts, man. A very special guest today comes from Wall Street, like the rest of the criminals. I joke. His name's Tom Filer. He's the managing director of Fountain Wealth Associates, LLC, an asset consultant in wealth management and natural resources. Tom is president and the registered principal of Commodities and Securities, Inc., a commodity trading advisor registered with the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, the CFTC, and a member of the National Futures Association, NFA, which I believe is going to be disbanded by Barack Obama when he ends the USA, because the nation won't have a future. Commodities and Securities, Inc. as well, and he's also a registered investment advisor. Tom is a real estate agent in the state of North Carolina, specializing in farmland, agribusiness, and real estate investing. He's also a veteran of Wall Street for over 20 years, working in the financial industry in Lower Manhattan. And today he's going to unveil for us how the global financial system works to the disadvantage of, well, everyday American investors, and suggest which assets and strategies can help protect your money in today's treacherous economy and investment market. Some of you might be familiar with his work with Pastor Lindsay Williams. They put out a DVD together and put out some very important information for people to look at. Now, also, explaining the context, ladies and gentlemen, the advice and the views that you will hear tonight, just remember that there are professional analysis and opinion from the mouth of a investment manager, okay? And he's got a lot more warnings for you that you can't just suddenly hear this thing once on the radio and then go out and spend all your money on whatever Tom has said, because everybody's situation is different and you need financial advice if you're unable to discern it for yourself, and you shouldn't be able to do that on just one radio show. So, Tom Filer, if you're there, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Vinny.
Okay, so let's talk about some things. How does the financial crisis affect the financial assets of the American people?
Well, again, it's a pleasure, Vinny, to be on your show, and I appreciate an opportunity to speak with your audience and hopefully provide some insights and some suggestions to them with regards to how to approach investing or how to kind of consider their assets and where their assets might be to the best advantage for them. Just a quick sentiment, an opinion on the current U.S. economy and the global economy. And I guess, to simply put, it's pretty bad. The IMF and the World Bank are talking about a dramatic global slowdown, which we've really been in for going on 5 years now. So that shouldn't be a revelation to anybody. But from an investment manager's standpoint, and I appreciate you letting your audience know that anything they hear on this show or from me or they hear on television or on the cable shows about investing, they need to understand that they should really consult a professional before they make any decisions. I think this economic slowdown has been going on for years, and the one thing that we would caution people to understand is that the risk, investing or asset risk out there is probably, in our opinion, as high as it's been. And probably it's greater than going back 5 years ago from that period of 2007 and 2009, when, for example, the stock market declined 37 to 50%, and, of course, real estate and other assets plummeted dramatically, with the exception of some assets. For example, precious metals did very well during that period, as well as commodities. So while we caution investors to be very risk-sensitive right now, but also to be opportunity sensitive as well, because even during bad times, There's also opportunities out there that if you first have your assets protected, and then you've got your assets positioned for opportunity, there's opportunities out there even in the worst of times.
So have you ever had somebody come up to you and go, Tom, how do I cover my assets?
I like that. They do, actually. Just staying on the topic of risk management, if you're working with an investment advisor, I would call him or her up immediately, and ask them, what is their risk management plan? What is their risk management strategy for your assets or for your portfolio? And, we've written a wonderful article on risk management and what it is and what are some of the methods of it. And I believe I'll be able to get some information out where you can perhaps contact me and be able to access information like that. But protecting your risk assets is very, very important right now. And that's really the first thing you need to do immediately is to first protect your assets and make sure that you have risk management methods and strategies deployed on your portfolios and your assets.
And the point is, of course, not all investments are appropriate for everybody. I mean, what kind of a – who's your normal client base?
Is there such a thing? My firm has a broad base of clients. We do securities work. That'd be stock market, stocks and bonds and mutual funds, ETFs. We also do futures. So that's in the commodities and energy and the agribusiness complexes. And we also do natural resources. We help clients make decisions on buying precious metals and things like farmland and direct investments in grain assets, grain and other agricultural assets. So we're very broad. So we work with large institutions, but we also certainly, of course, have a heart for everyday Americans, everyday people. And so, we've been able to design some products which normally large institutions have only had access to be able to invest in. And we've been able to create opportunities so even the so-called retail investor or everyday Americans can invest in some of these what they call alternative investments, which include some of those things I mentioned, natural resources, farmland, and other things like that.
So you haven't ever been employed by the Rothschild family to access some resources out of Africa, have you?
I have not, no.
You'd probably be a lot wealthier if you did. The concept of wealth management is something that's alien to me, principally because I don't have any wealth. What would your advice be to somebody who, in this time of financial crisis, actually doesn't have anything?
One of the first things to do is to just begin to, organized and in a consistent plan, begin to build some savings. And, we start with clients from the very beginning of asking them, what is your household budget, or do you have a household budget? And that's the place where you really start. And that's where we start with people, because, you shouldn't be investing on the top end, which is kind of like the final result of the below end of financial planning. And the lowest end, the first primary, thing to do is to create a family budget. So for anybody who is looking to begin to invest or to begin to save to invest, to create a budget, an individual or family budget, and begin to just very slowly save and put away money. And then as you very slowly accumulate it, then begin to invest it in assets which are appropriate for you and which can meet your objectives, whether it be for short-term, medium, or long-term.
And at the moment, do you believe that a financial crash or hyperinflation of something of that nature is on the cards? And in if that's the case, if you think that, what could people do? Because they essentially have no time to make savings and then go on to make investments because the landscape will change. Or is it the old case that the more things change, the more they stay the same?
Well, I would say that things are changing, and in this world today, and in our country, and I think things are changing in the globe, and which are not the same as anything that we have faced before. I think what's going on out there with the buildup of global institutions and is something that is very unique today. Some of the products, some of the financial products that are out there are unique to today, and they are having an impact on our financial system, which no products have ever had that type of impact. And I'm referring to one financial product is derivatives, and I believe that we'll have an opportunity, Vinny, to talk about derivatives tonight. So I'm not sure things are the same. I think things are changing, you know, quite dramatically. Now, the question of, you know, will there be a financial crash? And I think people need to understand, and I think they do. I think from 2007 to 2009, people, you know, understood that there was a financial crash. And as a matter of fact, on one fateful evening in September 2008, Ben Bernanke, Chairman Ben Bernanke of the Fed, and then Secretary Paulson went before leaders in Congress, and they literally are reported to have said, unless Congress was to divvy up $800 billion or so of U.S. taxpayer money, by early that following week, the entire global financial system would implode. It would just totally freeze up. And the aftermath of that, I think people, you know, all across the world in the United States, you know, realized there was a crash. You know, stock portfolios crashed 30, 40, 50%. Real estate values crashed 30, 40, 50%. People's credit lines, you know, crashed. And so I think people understood then and felt, you know, what a financial collapse or crash is. But I would say that that so-called crash, it's continued. In other words, you know, I think people need to understand that you shouldn't sit here and just wait for a crash or think that there might be a crash coming forward. We're in the midst of one right now. And so I guess you might call it a kind of a slow motion crash. And unfortunately, I think some people have been lulled to sleep. You know, they realize, and they were very negatively impacted between 2007 and 2009. But you've got many Americans who are back in the stock market, back in investing in mutual funds, back in and kind of doing the same thing. And there's a reason for that, and which I think we're going to get to today. They're back in doing the same things that they were ill-positioned, you know, for in 2007 and 2009. So that's one reason why I'm blessed to be on a show like this and be able to speak to people and try to raise some of the warning signals and to also kind of get the word out on what you need to kind of think about doing so that you're not negatively impacted as you might have been from 2007 to
9. Or at least hopefully lessen and cushion the blow, because this is something I feel has been in the works for far, far longer than just since 2008. I believe that there is a planned agenda, a deliberate desire by the elite to destroy the United States, and more to the point, to destroy everybody's financial industry and or take control of it, because he who has the gold makes the rules, and basically they're going to get to the point where they can manufacture things out of thin air and turn it into gold. And sure enough, they are. They make up fake money and then buy gold with it.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, Vinny, I think you're exactly right there, and that's kind of the big change that's going on out there. You know, the world today is like it's never been before, and if I may kind of refine what you said there, whoever owns the gold, you know, makes the rules. Today, and, you know, what I like to try to point out to people is that if you understand where things are headed, it doesn't mean they're going to get there. I don't think, you know, the final chapter is written yet. But, you know, if you understand where things are headed and who's pushing them that way, and you identified, you know, the global elite, then you can see the fingerprints of how what they're doing to get the system to build a new world order to a global system. You can see the fingerprints. And one of the fingerprints, and I would kind of revise that rule to whoever holds the debt makes the rules. And that's never been so evident than in Europe right now. And, you know, Vinny, we were talking about this a little bit earlier today, where, you know, the one thing, if you're going to create a global system with more centralized rules and regulations and values and ideologies, it's very difficult to herd, you know, into a pen 100, 200 sovereign countries. And so what you want to do is you want to try to group them together. I guess there's an old saying out there, it's very hard to herd cats. It's like very hard to control 200 sovereign countries or so. And so what you need to do is you need to kind of group them together. And so you're right, Vinny. Many years ago, the plan was hatched, the EU...
It seems to... we're coming to break. Tom, we're coming to break. So I want to talk about the EU, the financial crisis, and just exactly how we got into this situation so we can figure out a way out of it. We'll be right back after the break.
I got some so-called friends. I'll smile right to my face. All when my back is turned.
Bell's on a trade deal.
They like to bury me without a trace.
Welcome back.
Oh, no, no.
You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. I want to know, ladies and gentlemen, just whose side are you on? Are you on the side of truth, entrepreneurship, honesty, integrity, morality, some kind of calling higher than yourself, that you recognize that you can do a heck of a lot more for the world if you stop being so selfish and start seeing that there are higher callings for your talents and gifts? Are you on that side, ladies and gentlemen? I certainly hope you are. My very special guest who joins me on that other side of the line is Tom Filer. Welcome back. We were talking about the EU, and many people would understand, maybe this radio audience would, that the European Union came out of the European Economic Community, and it was even discussed at a Bilderberg Group meeting that the way to create super states and to subvert sovereignty is through quote-unquote free trade. And just like with most principles of the New World Order, they come in telling you the opposite of what they're going to do. They come in and tell you we're going to financially stabilize everything. We're going to reduce the debt. We're going to increase production. We're going to make things run a little bit smoother. And sure enough, it appears as though things do run a bit smoother for some people, and then the opposites start to come into effect. And now you have a situation, say, in Greece, where what have you got, 25% unemployment, and the New World Order banksters are coming in, seizing their assets and control over the economy. That's how they get you. The financial trade deals, economic partnerships are simply the worm on the hook. So I was wondering, Tom, what's your perspective on all of this? Because speaking of hooks, you seem to have the hookups.
Yeah. Yeah. What you just outlined there is exactly right. You know, the plan to try to consolidate regions into blocks that are a little more easily controlled is a good example of the EU. If you go back to 2006, for example, the IMF released a position paper, I guess, that it was time to move the EU into, you know, from simply a currency union to more of a political and financial union and monetary union. And, of course, you I'm sure remember that when the union was being formed, you know, the word was, or the deception was that just going to be a currency union, nobody's going to invade anybody's sovereignty, and there wasn't going to be any type of financial or, you know, union or monetary or political or anything like that. But that's exactly where they're headed. And in 2006, an IMF paper, International Monetary Fund, and, of course, if you really want to know what's going on, follow that organization, and you'll very much see what's going on out there. It began to say it's time to move into this greater union. And, of course, that was in 2006 when we weren't in this financial crisis. And in 2006, of course, there wouldn't have been any impetus for any of the European countries to do that. You see, so it took a crisis to force them into, you know, greater union and into greater control. And now virtually the entire, you know, EU is controlled by debt. So whoever holds the debt makes the rules, and the IMF is on the giving end and the holding end of a lot of debt all throughout the world, and it's the global elite, globalists, who are using the IMF as an instrument to spread debt and then to be able to, you know, make the rules. If you think about it, debt is really a more effective weapon for control than military war is, because military war destroys, and whereas, you know, debt is much more cleaner, and it's something that can actually control people even more than a military conflict can.
I remember reading, what was it called, The Bourne Identity, and he was the character was having a coffee with a lady in a cafe in Montreal or something, and she was telling him that debt is a far more effective weapon of war because, well, basically, your scars of war heal because eventually peace is reached, whereas the scars of debt never heal, for you are forever bound to them. And so it is a much more efficient way of taking over a country or a person.
Interesting, yeah. Well, if you kind of, you know, follow the patterns, you know, of the globalists and putting together a globalist system, that leads us, I believe, to the Middle East. And I think there's a lot of Americans wondering what's going on in the Middle East and what's really going on in the Middle East. And the Middle East, in our analysis, is the next region that the globalists are working on. And, of course, one of the tasks of the globalists in order to build a new system is to depreciate or to dismantle certain aspects of the old system. And, again, so that's where you start noticing fingerprints of the dismantlement. And one of the biggest things that is being dismantled in the Middle East right now is Western influence in the Middle East. The United States and other Western countries have had a dramatic influence for decades in the Middle East, and that's of no use to the globalists because the globalists can't have the West or can't have a country like the United States with excessive or undue influence in an area because it doesn't fit the more, you know, equality of a global system. So that's what's being done right now. And if you take a look at the governments that have fallen throughout the Middle East, they're predominantly Western-supported governments or governments in which the West had a lot of influence with. And you can start right with Mubarak of Egypt. The United States had a lot of influence with Mubarak. And and Mubarak, of course, being a dictator, was really in it for himself, in it for the power and the wealth to rule Egypt, but also in it for the people of Egypt as well. And, of course, the globalists would have no use for a dictator like that, and nor a dictator for the globalists like that. So Mubarak had to be taken out of power, as well as, for example, I think you can say the same of Gaddafi down in Libya. In 2003, Gaddafi kind of flipped, and I know you know, Vinny, that he handed over all his weapons of mass destruction and then began doing business, you know, with the West and with Europe, selling a lot of oil to Europe. And so that's another example of a Western-influenced country in the Middle East, or that's North Africa, actually, that had to be removed from power in part of this reconstruction process for the globalists.
It's the crisis management shock doctrine, I've found. People, when they are not afraid, can think, and they can be hesitant because they have the capacity to. When people are in deep crisis, fear starts to manifest in the mind. Fear stops you from thinking and starts you acting. So what happens is people will naturally gravitate and listen to the people who appear to be thinking and who appear to be trying to save them, and they trust them implicitly because they have no ability to see past the fraud.
That's right. And, you know, if I may, Vinny, relate kind of a little personal story with the Middle East, but kind of preface it with the concept of the Arab Spring was really just a marketing tool for the globalists to begin the dismantlement of Western power and many other governments in the Middle East. There was no Arab Spring. There was no purpose move towards democracies throughout the Middle East, but it was used as kind of a marketing tool because, you know, people wanted to believe that. People wanted to trust that, you know, people who value democracy and promote democracy are people of peace, are people who want to change things, not through violence, but through consensus and then, of course, through the election booth. And so I think you're right there that, you know, people wanted to have confidence that these were the groups that were actually moving the changes or the prospective changes in the Middle East. But that's turned out not to be the case at all. The groups that have moved the change in the Middle East have been the violent groups, have been the terrorists. And if you think about it, you know, that's how change is taking place in the Middle East, not through election, not through people who believe in democracy. But the globalists are funding terrorists to destabilize countries and then destabilize governments. And anybody you speak to in the Middle East will say that, you know, it's outside influence, which is at the base or at the heart of all the violence and all the changes that are going on in the Middle East. From a personal standpoint, I've been blessed to do business. I do business. My firm does business in the Middle East, and I've traveled over there, and I've gotten to know the people over there, and they are some of the nicest people in the world. The hospitality over in the Middle East is just wonderful. I can tell stories about how it takes me all day to just conduct a few business meetings because when I go from place to place, they treat you with, they give you tea, they give you cookies, and you have to spend an hour or two just enjoying yourself with them before you sit down and you start doing business. And so it's a very long day to try to conduct a few business meetings. But the people's heart in the Middle East is just wonderful, and it breaks my heart to see the violence that's being, you know, stoked and that's being used to dismantle many of the structures of the Middle East right now. To see what's going on in Syria, the Syrian people are some of the nicest people in the world, and to see what's going on, it's just heartbreaking that tens of thousands of people have been gunned down in the streets of Syria, and yet it's all being stoked by outside powers supplying weapons to terrorist groups to destabilize the governments in the Middle East. It's an awful situation, and it's really got to be better exposed what's really going on out there, so the symptoms can be addressed as opposed to the fallacies that's going on there.
You see these people coming out like Gaddafi did. Hey, we don't like the idea that Henry Kissinger came to the Middle East in the 70s and said, hey, you've got to sell your oil in US dollars. We'll make you very rich men. And all we want you to do is to buy the US national debt. We want you to buy treasury bonds. So they did. They made themselves incredibly wealthy. But now they're holding ridiculous amounts of US treasury bonds that are soon to be worthless. And they will have nothing, and their countries will be taken from them, just like they took the countries from their people. That's how the New World Order works. They're not only setting the people up, but they're setting up their fall guys to take the blame.
Absolutely, yeah. And again, keeping in mind that everybody's always taking. Earlier today we talked about, I'm blessed to have a degree in both history and political science, and so the study of history is just the study of the horrible treatment, you know, by the powers that be in any given period of history against, you know, the average everyday people of a country, and that continues today. So it's all taking. The only country where, certainly in modern history, where that's not occurred is the United States. The United States has had values that have been endued by a creator, and those are where we get those values, and they're not given to us by an elite or by somebody with power, but they're God-given. And so America has been an exception. And unfortunately, though, I've got to say that we've paid a horrible price for a move towards globalism. And you mentioned it right there with regards to values. Free trade, you mentioned free trade a few minutes ago and how that is supposedly used as a way to unite countries. But what free trade has been used for is to assimilate the United States into a global system which does not have the values that America has. And that's how free trade has been used. And so, for example, if you take a look at the United States' relationship with China, China, in my humble opinion, as a government, the Chinese people are wonderful people, but the government is a brutal communist government, and very brutal. But free trade, you know, has kind of, you know, softened or erased that distinction that Americans, I think, today have. And the demise of the values, American values, vis-a-vis international trade, perhaps is sadly traced back to America in 1994. And that's when the U.S. government then officially delinked China's adherence to human rights from trading privileges with the American people. So that was delinked. So no longer did China have to adhere to some reasonable standard of human rights to be able to trade with the United States. And so as Chinese-American trade relations flourished, so did the Chinese government's crackdown against free speech, political rights, and religious practice. And also this so-called enlightened trade and economic cooperation has led the United States, unfortunately and tragically, to slavishly chain ourselves to debt to a communist country. So that's why we kind of began this segment with the concept of whoever holds the debt makes the rules. And America has tragically put ourselves in debt substantially to a country, China, which does not share our values.
Well, and indeed that is the case. But here's the question. Are the current rulers of America communist in value systems? I think so. We'll be right back after the break. Segment of the first hour. We have one more hour to go after this, and I think we were going to try and open it up to callers. The calling number is 218-339-8525, 218-339-8525. Tom Filer is my guest, an associate of our mutual friend and acquaintance and colleague, I guess, at this point, Pastor Lindsay Williams, has been revealing secrets of the elite and the financial crises, planning, staging, with stunning accuracy for some time. And so when Lindsay wants to get some advice, he goes to Tom sometimes. So it's very, very useful information that we hope to get out of him here. Now, we were talking about the Middle East situation and how they're destabilizing there to perhaps, do you think that they're trying to bring about a Middle East Union type thing by destroying all the current governments there? Because I see what happens with, let's say, Libya. There was zero debt in Libya. State-owned bank, no debt. It was illegal to charge interest in Libya. Well, he's obviously a dictator and a bad person. Let's bomb him, get him out of the way, and put Al-Qaeda in charge. And sure enough, that's what happened. Right. In fact, there was even an Al-Qaeda flag raised in Libya after Gaddafi was taken out. And being supported by U.S. intelligence and forces and things of that Rothschild global military nature. And similar stories I've heard coming out of Syria that the Assad... don't you love the overusage of the word regime, Tom? The Assad regime, the regime, all right? There's so much repetition that goes into it, so it instantly makes me think, okay, they're trying to brainwash me and they're trying to propagandize me into thinking this guy's a regime. So who is he really? And it turns out very similar situation to Libya. Very little debt and high education among women and general peace in the streets and things like that. So naturally he's a dictator, so we have to take him out. And sure enough, British forces, US forces, and a number of other different Western military counterparts, essentially, have been spotted in Libya supporting the rebels, staging attacks and things like that. So it's a complicated situation, but it's very simple. There is a big region there. It has a lot of wealth, a lot of people, and it is surrounded on all sides by major powers. You've got the African Union to the south. You have the massive forces of China to the east. And you have Russia to the north. And, of course, you have the European Union to the west. So it's kind of like a gateway drug of a union that they're trying to set up here, because that's where a lot of the remaining oil production is. And other places simply aren't allowed to drill for their oil. I mean, Hugo Chavez doesn't have a problem with that at the moment. And they've got very little public debt. So naturally, I assume that they'll probably be experiencing some Al-Qaeda-like attacks soon enough anyway.
Yeah, that's right. And in the recent passes, there was already talk of a union of Middle East countries among the Gulf, so-called Gulf countries in the Middle East. That was a few years ago, and also talk that union not using petrodollars, you know, in their oil trade. So, you know, again, ideas begin, and then they, of course, take seed over time, like what's happened with the EU. But you know, talking about, you know, different relationships. Well, no sooner did the Morsi government take power than President Morsi went and he visited Iran and spoke to them. And so that's a kind of a new relationship that's being built there. And there was even talk that Egypt may want to build nuclear power, and talk that maybe they could have some sharing of information with Iran. So that's one thing that people need to watch for very, very carefully and kind of Google back and try to get some background information on that, but that's something that's been discussed. Also, I'm going to make a statement here, and I'm not sure we can explain everything on the show today, but there may be some things people want to just kind of keep in their minds and watch out for. But Morsi also, President Morsi of Egypt, also went and spoke with the Chinese leadership, and they're looking for loans from China. Also, and again, here's one of those fingerprints that you need to kind of notice out there. No sooner had the Morsi government taken power than the IMF has knocked on the door of Egypt now, and they want to begin to offer loans to Egypt, a la, you know, what they've been able to do over there in Europe. You see, so these are just some of the fingerprints of what's happening there. Now, one thing that I don't think, Vinny, I've heard this question asked, though I don't get out much perhaps, and maybe some people have asked it, but the Egyptian military has always been, even under the shadow of Mubarak, has always been a very powerful institution unto itself. And I think we saw the specter of, even after Mubarak fell, the Egyptian military remained very, very strong and were very strongly influencing events and the shaping of the situation in Egypt. But then all of a sudden, the Egyptian military surrendered, so to speak, to the Morsi government without a shot being fired. And you wonder, you know, how that happened. So now you've got the Egyptian military under the control of Morsi, and of course, formerly, perhaps still, the Muslim Brotherhood. And but how did that happen? And if you take a look at, again, fingerprints right here, that was actually U.S. policy. And I think one of the questions, or one of the examples you might use is a, I guess, a lion is, without its teeth is powerless. And so what has happened in Egypt was back in December, and this kind of weaves in the value system of America versus other countries in the global world order. Back in December 2011, the U.S. Congress passed legislation contingent for Egypt receiving military arms, contingent on their new government protecting freedom of expression, freedom of association and religion, and guaranteeing due process of law. The Congress said that whatever new government's going to take over in Egypt, they're not going to get military aid unless they follow some of these what are U.S. values. That was in December 2011. In March of 2012, the Secretary of State of the United States waived these requirements. So once again, just as back in 1994, the U.S. government waived human rights requirements with our relationship or trade with China, in March of 2012, the Secretary of State waived these regulations that were passed by Congress in December 2011 under the pretext of national security. In June of 2012, the Secretary of State said, quote, the military, the Egyptian military, must hand over power to Egypt's presidential winner. That was in June 2012. And then just a few months ago in July, the Secretary of State prodded the Egypt military to hand over power to the civilians, now government under control by Morsi. And what simply happened there, why did the Egyptian military just give up power to the Morsi government? It was very simple, going back to the example of a lion without teeth has no power. Well, a military without weapons also has no power. And so, of course, the U.S. was the largest and predominant supplier of weapons to the Egyptian military.
Indeed, the Egyptian military, I believe, were trained. I believe one of their prime directives is to protect the president. I found it very interesting. I was watching this revolution take place. I was like, yeah, right, revolution of the stomach, more like a whole bunch of people incredibly starving, food prices doubled. No wonder they're angry. They get out there and they blame Mubarak for all their problems. And sure enough, they start to accept a military dictatorship for a short period of time. Before they hold elections to elect a non-secular Muslim Brotherhood organization, which allegedly was even founded by the CIA in order to recruit the best and the brightest in the Muslim world to use them to control the Middle East.
Yep.
So it's a one-step, two-step, three-step. It's one of my favorite sayings, Tom, is, it's a tangled web we weave. Oh, a tangled, tangled web indeed. And people have not realized that we are caught up in the entanglement, and that there are many facts, pieces of history that are simply not public knowledge. A lot of people would say that it's public knowledge that 9/11 is an inside job, but the entire public would not be able to explain to you exactly how, who, or why. In succinct terms. It's the difference between something being common knowledge and somebody having intimate knowledge, right? The game changes, essentially, which is why I'm very glad that I've got you here to get some intimate knowledge on the financial sector as well. In the second hour, I wanted to get into derivatives and expand on that quite a bit, and also take some callers. Ladies and gentlemen, you can call in now. The lines are open, 218-339-8525. That's 218-339-8525. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. and we'll see you just after the break on the other side. Together, united, or we hang separate with the dangly legs and such. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's now hour number two, fastest 2 hours in talk radio with my very special guest, Tom Filer. Now, Tom, we wanted to get into talking about derivatives for just a moment, and also I want to remind listeners the caller line is now open. So call in. The number is 218-339-8525. That's 218-339-8525 is the number to call. We have one caller on the line at the moment. Tom, would you like to preface derivatives for a moment before we go to the caller?
Might I, if I could, Vinny, just go back and maybe finish a thought on our U.S. relations with China?
Go.
And I might say the unsavory U.S. relations with China, in that we've, as the people in the United States, we've sacrificed some of our values to have that relationship, and of course we've allowed ourselves to get in debt to a communist government. Not everybody is taking it laying down. I'd like the listeners, when they have an opportunity, to log on or to go onto the website and go to a organization called divestpersecution.com. divestpersecution.com. This is a group of money managers who have decided not to buy or recommend the stocks, the publicly traded stocks, of the government of China. In other words, that's owned by the government of China. There are publicly traded stocks on U.S. and other exchanges that investors can buy. They're publicly traded, and they're stocks that are owned by the communist government of China. And a group of investment advisors have decided not to recommend those companies to investors. Now, the Chinese people are great people, so this is not against this campaign against the Chinese people. And there's many other opportunities to invest in China without investing in public traded companies that are owned by the communist government of China. So I just wanted to mention that there's active movements out there that are addressing what many people feel are an unsavory relationship with China.
This is indeed unsavory times we're living in. So let's go to that caller now. Elizabeth, you are on the air.
Hi, gentlemen. Tom, thank you so much for your work. I just wanted to say I'm with you for the last, 2 weeks or so. I've just been sick about thinking serious, just getting pounded. You know, down goes another Middle Eastern country for what and the suffering that goes on over there. I had a couple of quick questions for you. I'll preface that first with, you know, I've kind of followed Pastor Williams' advice for the last few years, and I haven't gone wrong yet. I mean, he's just been right on about so many things as far as divesting from a lot of stuff, but my question is with Bernanke's last move with what seems to be
There's some kind of Close Encounters of the Third Kind sort of sound organ panel going on behind you there. What is that?
I was standing near a window, and it's wind in my wind chime. I'm so sorry. I'm so used to hearing it. I wasn't even paying attention. I hear it all the time. It's windy. I'm sorry.
I don't know. When it came across the line like that, all I heard was...
I apologize for that. I'm sorry. It's just the wind just kicked up, and I'm just used to hearing it. Anyway, no, my question is, I'm really concerned. I don't think, you know, whatever, 98% of Americans understand what went on with this last QE, whatever you want to call it, infinity, with, you know, mortgage-backed securities, and that at some point, I mean, there's just this endless cycle that, you know, these mortgage-backed securities, that everybody's house, basically, you know, their mortgages are now owned, and they can be sold and resold and whatnot. My question is I followed the advice. I got out of my McMansion, bought a little house, paid cash, you know, but what am I supposed to do when I've got, you know, every neighbor in a 50-mile radius who's got a mortgage that will soon be owned by the Federal Reserve and then, you know, reissued as a hedge or security to whomever?
That's a great question. And, ma'am, what's your name?
Elizabeth.
Elizabeth, okay. First, I just want to say that I appreciate your sentiment about as well being sick about what's going on in Syria. That really is a good country, and they are just wonderful, wonderful people. And it really is sickening and sad what's going on there. I think you hit a number of good fingerprints to, if I can continue to use that analogy of what's going on out there. You mentioned a cycle. You know, I just mentioned that you know, Chinese, certain governments, they own, you know, industries, they own companies. The government owns it, and unfortunately, that's begun to happen here in the United States, where there's a car company which is owned by the government. There's an insurance firm, our largest insurance firm in the country and perhaps in the world, is owned substantially by the U.S. government. Certain of our banks are owned substantially, not 100%, but substantially by the U.S. government. And the U.S. government already owned, and when I say U.S. government, it's really the people, but somewhere along the line, nobody's coming to me with making any decisions on what the government is doing with these things. But already the government owns Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, so the government really already owns, you know, the real estate system here in the United States. So what's really happening, and you mentioned the word cycle, money is just being cycled around, and that's all that's happening. So, you know, that the Fed is buying mortgages from banks, okay, is cycling money out of the banks, but then the QE puts the money right back into the banks, the quantitative easing puts the money right back into the banks. So it's just being cycled around, and that's what's really happening. When you really take a look at what's going on out there, money is just being cycling. For example, treasuries are just being cycled around. You know, China, Japan, a number of other countries have stopped buying as many U.S. treasuries. So... the powers that be here in the United States, they need somebody to buy our treasuries. And my partner and I, we noticed that in the first, for example, 3 months of this year, banks bought more treasuries than they did in the entire year before. So what simply happened is China, Japan buying fewer U.S. treasuries, so now the banks are buying more treasuries. The Fed and the Treasury keeps money flowing into the banks so they can buy more treasuries. And as far as mortgages go, the government already owns Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They virtually own, you know, 80-90% of all mortgages in the United States anyway right now. Now, what can you do was your question, and I think you did well to downsize. You did well to own it all cash. One thing, and I think later on the show we're going to kind of get into this, what else are some investment alternatives? And, you know, one of them is natural resources, and I love the concept of farmland. If somehow you've got any money where, you know, you can buy some farmland, and whether you lease it out to a farmer who then pays you a cash rent to use that land for what they need it for, or whether, you know, you set up a co-op on it, you know, there are food co-ops that have pops up all over the country. I think that there is a revolution in American farming and in the way people want to buy food. People today want to go to a farm and they want to pick food. They want to know where their food comes from. They want to know where it's grown. There's food co-ops all over the country. We're working with people to buy farmland and then to set up a co-op on this farmland, and they can make money on that co-op, you know, for the farmland that they bought. And people are blessed to come and pick their own food. Or the organic food system is growing dramatically, and many, many people want organic food, and they don't want food that's been genetically modified. So if somehow you could, you know, if you have some additional money, if you could buy some farmland and, you know, have somebody else farm it or farm it yourself, grow your some vegetables there. I think there's a movement by many people, as Vinny well knows, and he promotes this through his radio show, towards self-sufficiency in America. So as self-sufficient as Americans can get, I think the better off they'll be today, and I believe well into the future. And I think it's a good, prudent long-term strategy to be self-sufficient in your water supply, in your food supply, and with other things. But it's also, if there is a dramatic economic downturn or horrific inflation, again, being self-sufficient is one of the best ways to weather that.
Yes, and I absolutely have tried to do all that. And I know that you're probably well aware of how many issues going around with just that. It's, you cannot get USDA certified. I mean, that is just a mountain of bureaucracy. The second problem is I've got fracking going on within a 100-mile radius that could impact, you know, my water supply. I've got acreage. You know, I tried to do all the right things based on a mindset of 08, 09 and the crash. And it's like, yeah, I gather that farmland would be the deal. But, you know, my concern is now is, you know, I'm going to be a little hunk of farm with nice vegetables in a sea of foreclosed property that the government owns. But, yeah, I mean, all your points are correct, and I'm probably just being paranoid. But, you know, I mean, there just seems to be so much out of our control.
Can I ask you, Elizabeth?
I could mention something else, which I think is very, very important today, when just the concept of out of our control. You know, the founders of America, if I may say, created a government, which I believe was made for today. I think so many Americans are feeling that we're losing control, you know, from our government. There's a federal, there's a central government up in Washington, D.C., and I think many Americans feel we're losing control of our lives because of the regulations that you talked about right there. And yet, I believe the founders of our country understood human nature, and they understood that even though they designed a country where the federal government, a central government, would be given minimal power, and the states been given, you know, the greater power, I think they know what human nature was like. And as we see what's going on in the globe, human nature tends to want to consolidate power and have people consolidated, and then create a world in their own image. And so there's people here in this country who are trying to create a country in their own image, which is not in the image of the founders of our country. And yet we live in a country where it's a federalist country, where we have states, and states do and should have a preponderance of the power. So I would encourage anybody listening here to get involved in your state governments, get involved in your local, you know, governments. And I truly believe, and I've given word to the majority leader in our government here in North Carolina, I've sent word out that I want them to understand that their greatest responsibility is to protect the citizens of my state from an overly reaching or from an overly intrusive central or federal government. That's their role. And I believe our country's government was formed just for a time like this. So I would encourage everybody to get involved locally so we can protect just what you're talking about there, Elizabeth. We can protect farmland and regulations. We can affect the environment around us and where fracking or drilling takes place or where it doesn't take place. And for the first time in my life over the past 5 years, I've gotten involved in my local government here in my state. So I would encourage everybody to consider doing that.
Can I interject something here as well? You mentioned, Elizabeth, that you might be feeling a bit paranoid. Now, I've got a question for you. Are the banks out to get the remaining private property in America? Yes or no?
I firmly believe absolutely yes.
Then you're not paranoid because they really are after your property, okay? And you have a look at these deeper protocols like Agenda 21, I presume you're familiar with, where part of the protocol is to get people off the land and force them into the cities. Much like in the Great Depression, it used to be about 90% of people living in rural areas growing their own food. And when the economic crisis hit, a whole bunch of people became kind of transient and migrated into the cities looking for work. And that's basically the plan here. And fracking fits into that perfectly as well, because how many people are going to be living on the land if they can't drink the water?
And, Vinny, if I may say, you brought up a very good example of what I think I was talking about with Agenda 21. My understanding is the state of Alabama recently passed a constitutional amendment which stipulates that they will not abide by any regulations of Agenda 21. So there's a good example of a state protecting its citizens from... Now, Agenda 21 is not an intrusive U.S. federal government, though it is intrusive by the U.S. federal government, but this is a plot hatched in Rio de Janeiro. So it's a global. These are global plans and regulations. And so I guess I have to add, not only do our state governments need to protect us from an intrusive federal government, but also from intrusive globalism.
Well, this is the case, and in Rio de Janeiro in 1992, it was on Prince Philip's, not Prince Philip, what was his name? Prince Charles's private yacht in the Rio de Janeiro harbor, where they invited all the dignitaries on in secret to sign this document. It signed countries up to it. George H.W. Bush was there. He signed the U.S. up to it. Complete violation of U.S. standard protocols. You need congressional and Senate approval before you start entering into any kind of treaty. And more to the point, the Constitution frowns upon treaties and alliances like that because of the intentional corruption that it can breed. And the complications and how your people, friends, can turn against you and strike at you from the inside. And even the New Zealand Prime Minister at the time, Mr. Jim Bolger, who's since become High Commissioner of New Zealand in Monaco or something like that, living it up. That's the reward that you get for selling everyone else out. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Elizabeth, thank you very much for your call. The innocent small boy who was being tortured. There's too much electrodes shocking me through my testes. Yeah, welcome back. Also to my very special guest. I think that was kind of inappropriate. I'm sorry. my very special guest, Tom Filer. Now, let's get into derivatives. Okay, first of all, what is a derivative? I had one guy explain to me that a derivative is when you just pretend that $1 is $40 and then you gamble it on the stock market at 1,000 to 1. When I was out on the break, I thought about this, and I don't know if you've ever played poker privately. Just, you know, a few mates together, you put $10 in the pot, and then you get these chips. And this chip's worth $1,000. That chip's worth $500. That chip's worth $20, and what have you. There's only actually $10 in the pot. But the chips that you've got represent a huge amount of money if it was all real. And what the banking system has done essentially is a derivative is you go into your private poker game, you put $10 in, and they give you $10 million, except other people don't know that you're just playing with fake poker chips that ain't worth anything. and they give you real assets and real control and real financial power over you.
Well, I think that's a pretty good description right there. I loved your initial description of the leveraging, $1 or whatever into many, many dollars. And that's really the result of derivatives. In the simplest terms, derivatives or a derivative is a financial product that is made from or derived from a real financial product. And so, for example, I think many people would in the audience would understand that if you own a stock, most stocks have the opportunity to write options on those stocks. You can write a put or you can write a call option on a stock. So the option is a derivative, or that it's a financial product that's derived from the underlying stock product. So that's the simplest, understanding or form of a derivative, and there's many others like that. Derivatives are like most things in life in that there are good derivatives, and then there's derivatives that are not good derivatives, derivatives that have ended up being very, very destructive. What happens is exactly how you explained it, Vinny, is once derivatives start getting written on very large values of assets, one way the financial system makes money is by leveraging the funds that are written on that product. So derivatives are highly leveraged in an effort that the financial system, so the financial players, can make money. And that's really what it's all about, is derivatives are a system where the financial, we'll call them powers that be out there, the very smart people on Wall Street who created these products, it's a way for the global financial system and banks to make substantial amounts of money from our money, the money of everyday Americans who put money into the system. And I'd like to just quickly describe, kind of how that works and how it destabilizes the entire system with an example of money market funds. Now, most people believe that money market funds are very safe. They're marketed by banks as being and brokerage firms as being very safe. You put your money in there, you're supposed to get a decent return on the money that you put in there. And basically what you're doing is when you put money, whether it be in a checking account or in a money market fund, you're basically loaning money to that institution. That's what you're doing. Now, unfortunately, as you know, Vinny, today, we're basically, when you put your money in a bank, you're basically giving them, loaning them free money because we're not getting any return on that money to any degree, if any, with many of these products. And so I think that's one thing Americans need to understand is when you put your money in the bank, you're putting your money in their banking system, and then they're using it. They take the money market funds, and then they leverage those funds. They create debt and they leverage those funds, and one of the greatest forms of leverage is through derivatives. And so they leverage those funds, and then, for example, in the case of MF Global, which went out of business, they leveraged those funds and they wrote derivatives.
What does MF stand for? What does MF stand for? It's not what I think it is it?
Oh, I'm sorry?
What does MF stand for? It's not what I think
MF
it is
Global.
It?
MF Global was one of the largest futures commission merchants in the futures markets. It was run by John Corzine, a former senator and governor. And so this is what they did. They invested in the derivatives or created derivatives on, believe it or not, European bonds. And those bonds went south, and it brought down the entire company, MF Global.
Well, hold on. What year did that happen?
That was last year.
Okay. I was just thinking because my Prime Minister John Key was actually the head of the European bond and derivatives trade in the late 90s, I think, at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
Yeah.
So he kind of was one of the pioneers of actually setting that up. And now, miraculously, of course, somebody with such an intricate banking history winds up becoming in charge of this country and gets us miraculously into huge amounts of debt.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not sure I have time to tell a story, but just the concept that you mentioned there of how the players, the people who set up these derivatives, which crashed the value of so many people's wealth, they set up this system and they protected it and they promoted the derivatives system, and they kept it from being regulated. The people who concocted those plans are the ones that are in power today, you see. So these people who set up these systems, even though they crash our wealth, they're still in power because they're of course creating wealth for the bigger global players and for the elite. So I think that's maybe a quick primer on derivatives, how derivatives can take money market funds. And earlier this year, Ben Bernanke came out and he warned that if there were a run on money market funds, it could freeze up or bring down the entire financial system. And so that's an odd statement, I think, to most people, because we consider if our money is in a money market fund, it's safe. So how can money market funds bring down the entire system? Well, the reason for that is just how I described it, is that your money goes in a money market fund, then it gets diced, it gets spliced, it gets leveraged, it gets tied up in derivatives, written in derivatives all over the world. And so your money market funds are at great risk, and the money market fund system is at great risk to bring down the entire system, according to Ben Bernanke. This is how, when we put our money in the global system, the global system uses our money to create wealth for themselves. And the thing that everybody has to understand, that wealth is always created, okay, when profits are taken. In other words, if people own an asset and it goes up and you don't take the profit, then you've got a paper gain, but you haven't had wealth created until you take profits. And people have to understand that when profits are taken, there's two sides to that trade. There's people who make money on the profit, on the trade, and people who don't make money on the trade. So when the derivatives system, back in 2007 to 2009, what happened there in the derivatives system was the powers that be took their profits, which, of course, the other side of that trade was everyday Americans' real estate. The other side of that trade was everyday Americans' people in the stock market. The other side of that trade, you see. So what my company is trying to bring to people is to understand how not to be on the other side of that down trade.
Can we think of a creative solution to this problem? I thought of it like this. The debt is up there. It's numbering in the multiple quadrillions. And that's looking at it conservatively. So it's more debt than, in my opinion, most of the world's wealth is actually worth. And the reason it's there is because they just made it up. So if it's there because they pretended that it is, why don't we just pretend that it's not there and forgive all the debt?
Yes.
What do you think?
That might be the solution sometime in the future. Another interesting concept, Vinny, is derivatives, as I kind of described, they're really a creation or made possible by our money, by the people's money. One of the themes that we talk to our clients and investors about is the concept of how to get, you know, our money out of their system. Because that's what fuels their system. What fuels the system is our money. Again, there needs to be two sides of a trade. So you can't, the wealthy people can't drive the market up and then take profits if they're the only ones in the market, which would then drive their asset value down. So they need other people in the market, you see. And it's us. It's the everyday American who are the other people in the market that need to be there. What basically happened between 2007 and now the powers that be in the global system took their profits. It crashed our real estate, crashed our 401ks, it crashed our funds in the stock market. But then at the bottom, the powers that be need their system refunded. And the way they refunded the system were through bailouts. That's exactly how their system got refunded, or is in the process of being refunded. And now they're once again using our money to now, you know, build a higher asset base for themselves. And at some point, once again, they'll take their profits. And again, you do not want to be on the downside of that trade.
Will people lose everything in the main? Because that's what I see happening. In general, most people won't get to this information in time. And the crisis will essentially create a new system, one that is more or less free of the concept of private property, where you won't own your house, the bank will own your house, and they'll rent it back to you.
Well, you know, that's a possibility, but again, I would just go back to it. If that comes about, then we Americans have allowed it. We just allowed certain powers that be in the United States or in other parts of the world to foist that upon us. I speak to many people who have, in a sense, have given up. They just believe that we're on a course, and even being involved in democracy here in America is fruitless. And I must say that I'm certainly not at that point right now. I think I and many other people have fight left in us, and I believe that we have an American system here that we can use to protect possibilities like that. But going back to the concept of getting your money out of your system, well, you know, how can you do that? You know, if you don't have money in the stock market can crash, and you're not going to, you know, lose money. If you own real estate, or if you own assets that are productive for you, then they're going to be productive for you. So, for example, if you own farmland and it's producing food that gets sold to other people or used by yourself, you know, you've taken your money, you know, out of their system. A number of years ago, I noticed that I had all my personal and all my business assets in a large global bank. And so I got my money out of their system, and I put it in a nice, good quality, well-run local bank. Now, I'm not, you know, that's not a suggestion or recommendation for anybody, but that's one way I felt that I get my money out of their system and into a more local control on my part. One thing that in the DVD this past April with Lindsay Williams, I must say that my partner Mark Johnson handled an excellent, one of the best presentations on the technical aspects of derivatives and what impact that they have. And I would encourage everybody to try to get your hands on that DVD and listen to it if you haven't already done that, because there's an incredible presentation not only on derivatives but on so many other things. That DVD has really was 6, 7, 8 months ahead of its time. So many things that were spoken about in that DVD have unfolded, down through the time right here. But one last thing to say about getting your money out of their system is through small businesses. America is a country of small businesses, where people, through ingenuity, through hard work, through ideas that they have, and through creativity, have created just millions and millions of small businesses. And, you know, that's one way to, when you own your small business and it's a private company, well, you know, your business is out of their system. It's not in the stock market. It's not something that can be directly impacted. Your money's not being used by the powers that be out there. So that's something, that's a way to get your money out of their system. And so whether you start your own business or whether, you know, you become an investor in a good quality small business, that's another way to get your money out of their system.
Yeah, indeed. I think it's if you think about the global situation and you react to it locally, that's actually the best idea, because you're striking it at the heart. You're tapping the tree at the root, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back with Tom Filer. Final segment coming up, 218-339-8525. Back in a minute.
Thank you. just in time. Head down the 405. Gotta meet the new boss by 8 a.m. The phone rings in the car. The wife is working hard. She's running late tonight again. Well, I know what I've been told. You gotta work to feed the soul. But I can't do this all on my own. No, I know I'm no Superman. I'm no Superman.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Broadcasting live right here on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. 5 days a week, and I believe now Ifinity FM in the South Island is playing the show almost on the opposite time frame from, I think it's midnight till or 1 a.m. till 3 a.m. Local New Zealand time. So if you can't catch the show on this time zone, you can go to Ifinity FM or just Google that, .co.nz. And they will have a live stream running there for you. Now, my very special guest, Tom Filer, here today with us. Now, have we wrapped up derivatives, do you think, or do you believe it needs more expansion in this final segment?
If I could kindly give one more thought, which is probably one of the most important thoughts on derivatives, I'd appreciate that. Derivatives is just not a product that was created for wealth creation for the elite. And I'm not going to be able to fully explain this, so I think listeners, if you just kind of file this and just kind of watch out for indications of what I'm talking about here. But it was actually, derivatives were created by the globalists to help to construct this new world order. And Vinny, I know years ago, I'm sure you watched a wonderful movie called The Matrix. And I've begun using that concept as a way to get people to understand what the impact of derivatives are. What derivatives do is they really, like a web, tie the whole world together. You know, many years ago before globalism, there were, very small local centers of economic influence. Globalism, and especially with the use of derivatives, has really put a web and tied financially the world together. And it's acted as an overarching, derivatives act as an overarching matrix, which ties together everything from, right into our mortgages. So if you own a mortgage, more than likely that mortgage, has been part of the derivative system, or is part of the derivative system. So it really ties together the entire world, and it kind of creates a straitjacket on the entire world, which is used for control, financial control by the globalists. As I was explaining derivatives to a good friend of mine, as they described the evils of it, they kind of just commonsensically commented, well, gee, why don't they just close them down? Why don't they just stop the derivatives, just close them down? And unfortunately, you can't do that. They're so sophisticated and they're so interwoven into the entire world that that you can't deconstruct derivatives, and you just can't close them down. And they literally act as a matrix over the entire system, which keeps the globalists in control. As long as they control the derivatives, they control the entire financial system. Now, in saying that, I've just got to say that all is not lost. I believe that that there's ways in which America can reassert itself and get back on track under the right leadership and under the right circumstances. And I believe we can free ourselves from a lot of these structures and from a lot of the deconstruction of values which have spread around the world. And we can once again assert what our, I think, uniquely God created and given American values. So while the task is big, I believe that all is not lost, and that I think the possibility of a resurgent America is there to be able to overcome a lot of these systems that no longer represent our values.
Do you think that it's possible for America to enter a new golden age?
Absolutely. With the right leadership and under the right circumstances.
Speaking of the right leadership, will you be voting in this upcoming election?
Absolutely.
Who do you reckon is the good candidate?
I definitely have a choice, and I'd rather not reveal it, publicly. But I think I definitely have a choice, and there's no doubt about it.
That's fair enough. And that's the thing I find about the political system is that your choices are your own, and you don't have to make those public if you don't wish to. So let's jump across there. Now, speaking of which, in terms of being on radio or being on the DVD as Lindsay Williams or in the public eye, as it were, there are certain things that we do choose to hold back. And I wanted to ask you, it's sort of a leading question, and have you ever experienced this? There's been incidences and people coming out saying that people on Wall Street are very, some of them at least, very psychopathic in nature, a lot of cocaine use and prostitution, escort services, those sorts of things, living the high and frivolous life. And I'd act under the assumption that if that exists, then the direct opposite exists as well. People who don't blow their money frivolously and destroy themselves and or the morality and fabric of their society with their success. Because I think that it's actually something like you get so big sometimes and you get real full of yourself. And if you get too full of yourself, you get too far ahead of yourself. And I think that explains sort of some of the behavior that we've seen coming out of the financial system.
I would say absolutely. I think everything you just said there is absolutely representative of some people, maybe many people in the financial systems throughout the world, probably not only in the financial system, but in other so-called walks of life. I think that's true. But I will say this, is that there's many good people in the financial system. I'm part of a network of investment advisors who have Christian values. I helped to form an organization called the National Association of Christian Financial Consultants. And I've got an interesting story where many of the concepts for how to invest and how to manage money and how to look at money, when I was a young stockbroker, many of these concepts came from the Bible. Came from my many years of going to church as a young boy, created a seminars called Biblical Principles to Investing. And there's many, many, many people in the financial system who do have good values and actually do care about people's money and do care about how they as investment advisors advise them to the best benefit to them on how to position the money, as opposed to being usury towards their money.
So, can I ask, are you aware of a satanic element of the New World Order, that there is some kind of a black versus white spiritual war going on here, as well as a decent person versus, scumbaggery element?
I would just kind of refer back to some of our discussion today about how the values of this New World Order, in many, many instances, are not the values of America. And I believe American values came from God.
Well, this is the thing that I discussed with Pastor Lindsay about this. Your spirituality it ties you and restrains you in certain aspects. And in my experience, if you have power and or influence, having restraint is a very, very good and necessary thing. What I feel is the problem here is the people who are currently in power have no such constraints.
Well, I think you're exactly right. You know, Vinny, and of course, the old saying, the love of money is the root of all evil. Certainly applies.
It certainly does. So I'd like to thank you, Tom, for coming on the show with us today. Where can people get more information on you or perhaps access your financial services? Do you have a phone number people can ring, perhaps?
Sure. People can email me through my last name, FYLER at TIAC.net. That's TIAC.net. They can call me at 646-391-3549. And myself and some of my associates would be pleased to provide whatever feedback or information might be helpful to anybody's assets or their investments. We're pleased to do that. I've also got a website, which is www.essentialsinvesting.com. Essentialsinvesting.com. And then one last website I'll mention is www.wallstreettosmallstreet.com.
Tom Filer, thank you very much for your expertise and also your persistence at all of this. Ladies and gentlemen, understand, no matter where your life has been and no matter where you are now, if you choose to contribute to humanity, you will always contribute more than you ever thought you could. And also, you get to benefit from that as well, for the people you talk to and the feats that you accomplish in the name of doing good for the greater number. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. And thank you, Tom, for sharing your life with us. We'll be right back.
My pleasure.
Next tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen.